is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The Federal Reserve met this week, and it came as no surprise, they stood down. After raising interest rates for the first time in a decade, last December, if you remember, the projections that were being made were for 4 rate hikes this year as the Fed attempts to normalize monetary policy. But as it has done so many times in the past, they've had to scale that back on their projections for normalizing policy because it seems the data aren't cooperating, and they're always saying they are data dependent. So, Jim, as we start off the big picture today, what do you think they are seeing that caused them to stand down?
John, I think it has a lot more to do with just how fragile the world we live in has become. I mean, the Fed's monetary policy, if you think of what the Fed is trying to do and what the rest of the world is doing, the Fed is out of sync with the rest of the world, which has gone to negative interest rates, which has actually adverse implications for the U.S. economy. I mean, since the Fed began to tighten, first when it ended its QE program, and then actually tightening rates last year, take a look at what has happened. The markets have tightened considerably. If you look at what's going on in the corporate bond market, corporate spreads have widened between sovereigns. The debt has risen. The dollar has strengthened since 2014, which has impacted profits of major U.S. companies, and not to mention our manufacturing sector, which is contracting, and American exports. So it's, you know, everybody says, well, gosh, they only raised rates 0.25 point. Well, the impact of everything that they've been doing, just by talking about doing something, it has caused a reaction in the market. So even though the Fed has only raised rates 0.25 point, the impact has been far greater. The Atlantic Fed thinks that with the dollar tightening, the spreads widening between, let's say, corporates and treasuries, there's been almost 300 basis points of tightening. So it clearly shows the new realities that the Fed finds itself in today. It is hamstrung, John, and limited by its own actions and what it is actually able to do.
You asked me also, what would we need to see to continue raising rates? And I think it's worth pointing out here that the committee, most participants do continue to envision that if economic developments unfold as they expect, that further increases in the federal funds rate will prove appropriate over time. Most participants anticipate that, and that the pace will be gradual. As I emphasized, most empirical work attempting to assess what the equilibrium level of the Fed funds rate is, a level that would be neither expansionary nor contractionary, those assessments are quite low at this time. So there is accommodation in the stance of policy, and we do expect over time that neutral rate to move up, but, you know, we're not positive what the pace of change of that will be over time. But given that the economy is now close to our maximum employment objective, hopefully inflation is moving up. I mentioned, as you mentioned, recent readings on inflation have moved up. There may be some I want to warn that there may be some transitory factors that are influencing that, but certainly our projections are for a gradual increase in inflation, and the committee, at least most participants, continue to expect that if we follow along this course, that some further adjustments in the federal funds rate will be appropriate but gradual.
That was Fed Chair Janet Yellen stating what it would take for the Fed to hike rates further. Obviously, they're looking for, say, an increase in inflation and what they would perceive to be improving economic data. So far, however, they have not changed their policy in wanting to raise rates further, despite the fact that we have weak economic data and low inflation. But nevertheless, I mean, the market seemed to like the Fed's somewhat conciliatory, dovish tone, but the Fed still insists on telling the markets they want to go higher.
Yeah, I mean, the Fed is caught up in a bind when you think about it. They desperately really want to normalize monetary policy because they really want to be able to react and influence the economy. But they will be limited, John, in their ability to do so. In the last rate cycle, which began in 2004, it took the Fed 3 years to raise rates in quarter-point increments to the federal funds level of about 5%, which is typically when the Fed is raising rates to choke off inflation, and they normally raise the Fed funds rate to the 5 or 6% level. But even in the last rate-raising cycle, which began with the Fed funds rate at 1%, we're not even close to that yet, it took them 3 years because they could only raise rates at a quarter of a point. So even Greenspan was going gradually in the last cycle until, of course, they led to the financial crisis. So it took them 3 years. This time around, it took a whole year to raise rates only a quarter of a point. So it just goes to show you just how fragile the world's economic system has become.
But then, Jim, we have to ask, what were the significant points of this meeting? Because it looks like they still plan on rate raising, even though, as I just mentioned, we have weak economic growth and low inflation. The real question is, what are they projecting right now? What are they thinking is going to happen? And maybe the other question would be, are we just going to see a repeat of last year?
The median projection for the federal funds rate rises only gradually to 0.9% late this year and 1.9% next year, as the factors restraining economic growth are projected to fade further over time. The median rate rises to 3% by the end of 2018, close to its longer run normal level. Compared with the projections made in December, the median path is about 0.5 percentage point lower this year and next. The median longer-run normal federal funds rate has been revised down as well. In other words, most committee participants now expect that achieving economic outcomes similar to those anticipated in December will likely require a somewhat lower path for policy interest rates than foreseen at that time. I would like to underscore, however, that the participants' projections for the federal funds rate, including the median path, are not a plan for future policy. Policy is not on a preset course. These forecasts represent participants' individual assessments of what appropriate policy would be given each person's own current projections of the most likely outcomes for economic growth, employment, inflation, and other factors. However, considerable uncertainty attaches to each participant's forecasts of economic outcomes. Hence, their assessments of appropriate policy are also uncertain and will change in response to adjustments to the economic outlook and associated risks, as was the case between December and now.
I love the way she refers to our other Fed governors as participants. Why not just say, well, my, you know,
my
participants.
Colleagues, right, yeah.
Yeah, my colleagues are fellow Fed governors, but no, they're participants. Essentially, John, what you just said there, instead of four rate hikes, which were projected last December, it was supposed to be a quarter every quarter, the Fed is only projecting two rate hikes this year. And that seems to be the consensus right now. They'll go probably in June with a quarter of a point and in December. But even that is, if you take a look at the economic data, which is slowing, even that is kind of iffy, since the dot plot projects the rate to be somewhere around 0.9% by year end. So even if they were able to raise rates twice as they're projecting now, and that is still a big if, it would take the Fed funds rate to close to 1%, which is where, if you think about it, is where Greenspan started back in 2004. The Fed funds rate was around 1%. It just goes to show you how fragile the global economy and the financial markets are today. And what we're seeing unfold here are the final stages of what people refer to at Bank Credit Analyst as the debt supercycle, where over-debt-burdened governments find themselves limited in their ability to react with policy to stimulate the economy. So here in the U.S., the national debt will have doubled by $10 trillion. Interest rates are still close to zero. and we're experiencing probably the worst economic growth rates in the last half century. So despite, John, trillions and trillions of dollars of stimulus, the economy has failed to perform as government central planning has failed to produce the desired result.
Well, I think to a certain extent, capitalism is at risk. I mean, capitalism depends upon a spread between a borrowing fund and risk out on the maturity spectrum. And to the extent that that's very narrow, to the extent that savers can't earn anything on their money, then capitalism doesn't break down. But at the margin, it's hindered and hampered. And that's what we're seeing, I think, over the past several years in terms of economic growth. I don't think the Fed really has a sense that the negative interest rates really have a negative implication. They're looking to stimulate the economy via market prices, via asset prices, and have it flow down via a wealth effect, you know, to the rest of the real economy. I don't think that's happening to the extent that they think it's happening. And so because of that, what you cited and what I cited 5 minutes ago in terms of pension funds and insurance companies, the long-term effect basically hampers investment and hampers institutions with long-term liabilities and makes them less credit worthy.
That was Invesco's Bill Gross discussing the risk in markets and the economy due to Fed intervention and especially the suppression of interest rates and the damage it causes to both savers and to institutions.
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed this on previous shows, but the longer the Fed keeps rates this low, the greater they run the risk of creating a real crisis, especially in pension funds and financial institutions, as Gross just mentioned. You know, you take a look at insurance companies and banks, they depend on real rates of return and a real spread in interest rates. Banks need a spread on terms of what they pay you, the depositor, and what they can charge to you, the borrower. They need that spread in order to make a loan and expand credit in an economy. You shorten that spread, it makes it less likely they're willing to lend, because you remember every loan they make, they're not going to make money on every one of them. They run the risk that some of those loans won't be repaid. Now, one reason credit has been so slow to expand in this expansion is not only the level of debt, it's also the excess regulations that have been put on the financial system and the narrow credit spreads. Now, right now, Wall Street and the banks are the current whipping boy in this political election. But it has been government policy, John, more than anything else, that has been at the root problem of all of this.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
You know, that's a real famous quote from President Ronald Reagan. What is interesting is if you have watched the implosion of Mao Zedong's great flop forward, is what I call it, instead of his great leap forward, it was a great flop. The implosion of the former Soviet Union, all try through top-down government planning. It really amazes me that despite all of the failures and the mismanagements that we see by governments, and I'm saying governments, not just in the United States, but throughout the West right now, here in this country, one party even wants more involvement, more taxes, more regulations, more spending. And of course, that will just steepen the angle of dissent. What we're really seeing is the limitations of government planning, but at the very same time, the reluctance of people to give up the reins of control on that until it just becomes absolutely painful or necessary.
Well, government is always reluctant to relinquish power. In fact, they usually are trying to enhance their power, which is one aspect of this presidential election. But it's actually more than just that. I mean, the world is awash. I don't care where you're looking. If you're looking at emerging markets, Europe, the financial system in Europe is awash in debt. And governments are trying to re-stimulate their economy through borrowing and more risk-taking. The problem is debt itself, even though it is a good time to borrow with rates being this low, doesn't do any good if you can't qualify for that loan. There's a downside to low rates, and as Gross had mentioned earlier, it does damage to savers and financial institutions. So it really distorts economic activity. It robs savers from earning a return on their savings, pension funds from earning returns to pay out pension benefits, and banks from earning a spread on their loans. So the main beneficiary, John, as we have talked so many times over the last 4 or 5 years of financial repression, is government itself, because it keeps the cost of borrowing down for government. You know, we've mentioned this so many times, but if you take a look at every single year, the government adds more debt, and it's been doing that for the last 7.5 years. And for the last 7.5 years, the amount of interest paid by the government has been going down. We've increased our debt by $9 trillion, and government interest expense has fallen by $50 billion. So the main beneficiary actually is government itself.
Well, let's go back to Fed policy moving forward, their forward projections. It's real clear the Fed intends to raise rates. They're not backing away from that. So maybe the real question that we have to ask here, Jim, and tell me what you think about this, is it even possible to normalize monetary policy? Again, because we go back to past rate cycles, they were able to raise the federal funds to 5 or 6%. This time, the Fed's having difficulty raising rates just one time. And even now, they've pulled back. Remember, it was going to be 4 rate hikes. They've changed the rate hike projection from 4 to 2, and we're just in the beginning of the year. So can they ever get back to that level of, quote, normalization?
You know, as you just mentioned, they've lowered their rate hike projections going all the way out. John, it's not just what they've lowered for this year. They've lowered their rate projections going all the way out to 2018. And even then, if they all went as the Fed has planned, which is doubtful, we would be looking at a final Fed funds rate at 3.25, not 5 or 6%. So I would be really surprised if they get that far. The futures market, which has been more accurate than the Fed, has a much lower rate going forward. Right now, the Fed has the Fed funds rate at about 0.9% at the end of 2016, about 1.9% at the end of 2017, and at 2018, 3%, and by the time you get to 2019, it would be 3.25%. Now, that's what they're projecting now, and they brought down those projections for 2016, for 2017, for 2018. So they've lowered their projections all across the spectrum, but they're still way above the futures market, which believes they will ultimately end up in terms of where they are. The futures market has rates getting, listen to this, no higher than 1.25% and 1.5%. I mean, think about it. They began this whole process in May of 2013 when they announced the unwinding of taper, and it took them all the way to 2015 just to raise rates 0.25%. You know, if the futures market is right, and I tend to bet with the futures market, they've been more accurate in their assessment, 1.5 is a far cry from where the Fed is projecting where rates will be heading. The problem is, if rates get that high, it could add literally hundreds of billions of dollars of more interest expense to the government budget deficit, which could be a major, major problem.
Okay, so the question is, are they going to, at some point, stop trying to do this, realizing that they can't raise them as far as they used to be able to do it? Or are they going to go through that time-honored trial of raising things until something breaks?
I think they will stick with tradition. They will do what they always do, which is to keep raising rates until they put the economy back into recession, which is why we feel the business cycle has already peaked. So it is only going to get slower moving forward this year until the point we are back into a recession, perhaps, John, by the middle of next year.
Okay, so given the fact that the Fed may not be able to raise interest rates much further, and if we look at the fragility of the financial system worldwide, especially the large debt burdens of countries, that's where they find themselves right now. What happens, as you're projecting, when the next recession hits? I mean, are they out of wiggle room, or does it mean that we hit negative interest rates like Japan and Europe have already done?
Where we needed to add accommodation, we have a range of tools. And we know from the things we did in the past that we have a number of options with respect to the maturity, for example, of our portfolio with respect to asset purchases or forward guidance that remain available to us that are tools we could turn to in the unlikely event that we need to add accommodation. So negative rates is not something that we're actively considering.
You know, as you heard in that clip, the Fed still has options at its disposal before they consider negative rates. The real question, I think, remains as to their efficacy. I mean, monetary policy is best utilized and effective when it's combined with fiscal policy. The problem here is fiscal policy these last 7.5 years have been anti-growth. So just as, for example, in Japan, when Abe came in, with trying to stimulate the economy with monetary policy, he used fiscal policy to counteract it by raising taxes, throwing the economy back into recession. So to be effective, it would entail probably a new administration with a far more friendly or business-friendly growth policy for monetary policy to become really effective. I mean, it's hard to see that coming from the Democrats, given what both candidates are espousing. And it's probably be more likely with Trump, but it's hard to say what Trump would do at this point, especially when it came to, let's say, international trade.
Bill, does today's meeting, does today's press conference, does it amend your portfolio? Will you make immediate changes?
Yeah, I think to some extent. Obviously, it's a more dovish Fed. It seems to me that Stan Fisher has been overruled to some extent by Chair Yellen in terms of the forward policy. The dots have come down. I still think, though, Tom, it's interesting that the market, in terms of forward expectations for LIBOR and for Fed funds, only anticipates 30 to 40 basis points a year for the next several years. The Fed still is looking at 100. So the Fed is still way above the market. And to the extent that the market is lower, then to a certain extent, treasuries are fully priced at these levels.
That was Bill Gross again saying that, well, first of all, you're not going to find any bargains in treasuries. But given the Fed's pronouncements and considering what they might do, if you're an investor, what are you going to do given the probable recession by next year?
You know, we're still sticking to our defensive position with heavier weighting to short-term corporate bonds, usually in the 1 to 2 year range, because we think those yields will begin to rise as the economy weakens and we move into that recession. And also we're playing corporate arbitrage, cash takeovers. And I would say from a stock point of view, high dividend paying defensive type of stocks such as Staples. And we're also beginning to look more at the gold market, because I think that's what the gold market, as we talked last week on the show, is beginning to sniff out, is the ineffectiveness of monetary policy and also global interest rates, which make gold a more attractive investment. So, John, we're still playing defense, and we see playing that defense going forward. I don't see anything that would change this picture at all unless the Fed was to dramatically move in the opposite direction, move more towards more quantitative easing. The dollar would come down, which would ease profit burdens, but I just don't see that happening first. I think we have a slow grinding pace into a recession, which will be leading up to by gradual Fed rate hikes. Now, whether they get two more in this year, the consensus seems to be June and December. They'd raise in June, sit back. And of course, they don't want to find themselves in a position raising interest rates prior to a presidential election, especially Yellen being a staunch Democrat. So whether they get two this year, or maybe it's one, who knows? I mean, last year they thought they were going to raise rates more than one percentage point, and they actually only raised rates once. So a lot of it is going to be looking at the economic data, a subject that we're going to explore next.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
As many of you know, Financial Sense spends a lot of time tracking and monitoring and giving updates on leading economic indicators. One of the ones that we follow fairly closely is the Duke CFO Outlook, the Global Business Outlook, which is produced quarterly by Duke University. Joining us on the show today to speak with us about the most recent results provided by the survey is John Graham. He's both a finance professor at Duke University and a director of the CFO Global Business Outlook. John, before we get to some of the results, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about the business outlook provided by Duke University, its importance, and why CFOs?
So we survey CFOs because we're asking a lot of questions about financial variables. Do you plan to increase hiring or lay people off? What do you think will happen with your earnings? How about your capital spending plans? CFOs know these numbers by heart. You know, they don't have to go look them up. And so this is important. We figure if we send a survey and someone had to pause and go look numbers up, they're not going to finish it. So CFOs seem like the right people in terms of knowing the data that we're after. But probably more importantly, the survey is anonymous. CFOs tell us what their projections are for their company. They do tell us what industry they're in, how big they are, how many employees, et cetera. So we can do slices of the data and get a sense of various sectors, et cetera. However, because it's anonymous, what they can effectively do is tell us their business plans over the next year. So most of the questions are based on over the next year, what do you expect? And so as long as business plans come true, and then we have a crystal ball forecasting the future because, you know, the CFOs are telling us their business plans and we're aggregating those business plans across companies. And then we have a sense of where the economy's going or where the manufacturing sector's going, depending on how we aggregate. Now, are business plans always perfect? Do they sometimes change? Sure, that can happen. But overall, you know, past experience suggests that certainly over the 6-month horizon, business plans seem to more or less come true, right? You know, for not for every single company, but enough as you aggregate across companies. So it's a great way to get a sense of where the economy's going, kind of looking out the front windshield, if you will, instead of government statistics are really telling us more about what's happened in the past.
And welcome back to The Big Picture. In the last segment, we discussed the Fed's decision to stand down and refrain from raising interest rates already. The Fed has reduced the number of rate hikes for the year in half, the projected rate hikes, by the way. So apparently, since they first raised rates last December, they must have seen the data change. We would say this is a cautious move on the part of the Fed speaking this week, something quite different than what we heard from the Fed last December. And I think they were surprised. We started the year with stocks falling, rates on bonds dropping, commodity prices hitting record lows, and the dollar rising, all in reaction to 1/4 point rate hike. I think that may have taken them by a bit of surprise, or at least breathlessness, not to mention warnings from both the IMF and the World Bank to delay raising rates. Well, originally they warned before they did it. It's like, don't do it anymore. They ignored the warnings and had to be, I would say, dismayed at the way we started off the year. Remember, Jim, it was just chaotic as soon as we got back from the holiday vacation.
Yeah, the last couple of days of last year. And then it was just almost relentless, John, from the beginning of the year all the way into early February. And I think that's what scared them.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, when we come back from the new year, you know how things are slow in the new year? And I kept thinking, well, what are we going to talk about on the show? And I didn't have to worry about that.
No, plenty of news to talk about.
It was actually hard to keep up with, as a matter of fact. So they ignored the warnings from the IMF and the World Bank, and I don't know if the European Central Bank pitched in on that one as well, but they did that. So what we want to do in this segment anyway is take a look at the economic data and dive into the weeds and look for clues. Are there signs that the economy has peaked and we're now heading slowly down toward a recession? It's a gradual rollover, as we would call it, in flying. Or are there signs that the Fed could actually engineer some kind of a soft landing in the midst of all of this? So let's do that.
Well, you know, as far as the soft landing, that's always been the dream of central bankers, that they can sort of, you know, not too cold, not too hot, just right, the soft landing, John. That's next to impossible. I've never seen it. Anyway, there are a number of issues here at work when we take a look at the economy. And it's not just the economy. Part of the problem for the Fed is monetary policies are out of sync, so that makes the Fed's job more difficult. For example, the ECB launched a major stimulus program last weekend, a series of bazookas. So if the Fed has to continue to hike rates, the dollar would soar, doing further damage to U.S. exports, to manufacturing, not to mention its toll on corporate profits. So the economy is already showing signs of weakness. So that is where we should begin to look for clues if it is our belief we're going to be in a recession sometime next year. Now, the economic data, some of it has begun to improve, but it's just like anything else. I think, John, going forward, it's our belief the business cycle has peaked. So you're going to see a series of lower highs and lower lows as we go forward in the economy.
Okay, I know you follow the LEIs to assess the general direction of the economy. So last time we covered them, they were really giving somewhat mixed indications. I mean, there wasn't any clear sign, but indicating rather anemic growth. So the economy is growing, but it's a lot weaker than projected by economists, including the Fed. And we should point out that the Fed keeps getting their projections wrong, which maybe should be a point of worry if they're the ones setting monetary policy. So apparently, so far anyway, the Fed has drawn the conclusion that it should hesitate a bit more to raise rates and proceeding more cautiously after witnessing what happened back in January. And it would be interesting to see if the economic data going forward warrants this degree of caution. So if we're going to lay this groundwork of trying to monitor all of this, what are you watching?
You know, last week we discussed the data we're starting to see on the employment front. So, you know, at this point, we're looking at sort of those little nuance indicators that would be more reflective of something bigger coming down the road. And let's take the employment report. That's the big economic number that everybody looks at the beginning of the month. Now, while the headline number for the month of February, the number is coming down in terms of unemployment, and it was a good jobs number. However, John, the employment number is really a lagging indicator. But what I found interesting, and this is what sort of gave us somewhat of a heads up, is if you look closely at the numbers at the periphery, when we look at employment, we're starting to see some weakness with a reduction in temporary employment and the number of hours worked. Now, you think about it. When employers first begin to cut back due to, let's say, declining sales and profits, they begin with temporary workers. Those are the easiest to let go. Then what they begin to do is cut the number of hours worked. So maybe people that used to work overtime, they cut back on overtime. Now, after that, they begin to cut the workforce. And we're starting to see the first signs of cutbacks at the corporate level just this week. I mean, it's just trickling in at this point. It's nothing major. But if we begin to see these trends of declining temp workers and the hours worked begins to decline, down the road, this number should pick up. In other words, we should start to see the unemployment rate begin to rise. I mean, this week alone, Avon announced it would eliminate 2,500 corporate jobs, and it's going to move its headquarters to the UK in order to cut costs. It may be coincidental at this point, but it is something, John, that is worth watching.
The main economic indicators that you watch are the leading economic indicators, the LEIs, because they give you a heads up as to the direction of the economy. Are you using any other kind of correlative data that either adds to this or maybe contradicts it or shows that maybe interpretation should be somewhere else?
We like to look at small things. Sometimes they lead you in the direction of bigger things that may follow. I mean, you know, if you were in a recession, you heard the term looking for green shoots, looking for something that looks positive. And when you're in a good economic environment, you're looking for, use the analogy, falling leaves ahead of a downturn. One indicator we're following with interest is the buildup in inventories. Now, initially, when inventories build up, it's good for the economy because goods are produced and that gets added into GDP growth. However, when inventories start to build, that's usually a warning sign. The pace of U.S. wholesale sales is not keeping pace with the growth in inventories, and that appears to me that demand may be softening and a portent of possible cutbacks in production down the road. We're already seeing that with industrial production. So the data coming in from the manufacturing sector, which has been contracting, also reflects this ominous trend. I'll give you an example. Wholesale sales plunged an unexpected 1.3% in January. They've fallen again. And here is what we're looking for. The plunge in January was the fourth consecutive monthly decline. Wholesale sales are now down 6.4% from a year ago. And what we watch is the inventory to sales ratio. It keeps climbing higher. And that usually is not a good sign. It's a warning and means that manufacturers are producing goods, but they're producing more goods than what the sales are coming in. So we're starting to see these levels of inventory to sales levels approach levels that we haven't seen since a recession. For example, the inventory to sales ratio got to over 1.4 in 2008 and 2009. The January reading was 1.36. This ratio moved up a notch to 1.4 from 1.39 last month. Business sales dropped 0.4%. So whether you look at wholesale inventory to sales ratios or business inventory to sales ratios, they are all on the wrong side of this cycle low, which was 125, reached in 2009. In the high, 149 at the bottom of the last recession. So, John, things are beginning to move in the wrong direction.
Now, what about the consumer? I mean, this has been one of the bright spots in this recovery. Gasoline prices are low, but much of the savings have been eaten up by rising healthcare costs on the other side. So what does the health of the consumer look like?
I mean, retail sales fell last month, and the trend has been showing growing weakness. We saw that reflected in the fourth quarter. The Christmas season was weak last year. Now, the drop in retail sales last month reflected a drop in gasoline sales. Well, you know, the price of gasoline goes down. You would expect gasoline sales to go down as well. But the declines that we saw in retail sales were broad-based. I mean, it was all across the board, from furniture stores, grocery stores, department stores, electronics, appliance, to auto dealers. And we also saw weakness in building supplies, restaurants, apparel, to hobby stores. So if you see a few sectors, maybe weakness in auto sales or weakness in gasoline sales, a lot of that can be explained. You know, if the price of gasoline drops to a record low, you're going to expect to see a drop in gasoline sales because people are paying less at the pump. But when you're seeing a slowing trend emerge that is broader based, as we saw in this last retail sales report, and that slowing trend began to emerge in Q4 of last year, where we got weaker economic numbers, it's reflected in what we saw in the weak GDP numbers. So the trend in retail sales is also indicating a weakening trend. So those are the kind of little subtle things that you kind of look for. What we're seeing, and this would explain the buildup in the inventory to sales ratio, is manufacturers are still producing stuff, which gets added to GDP, but the stuff is starting to pile up in the warehouses because the sales aren't coming in as strong as they should be to match or keep pace with the level of production. And we know after a while, as the warehouses begin to build up with inventories, that is when you start to see manufacturers start to cut back. They cut back on hours worked. They cut back on production. And eventually, that's what you see as you head into a recession.
So it sounds like from what you're describing here, the trend in the economy really very clearly points to a slowdown, at least right now. And that's reflected in the lower GDP numbers. Even the Fed this week lowered its forecast for growth this year to barely above 2%, which, by the way, may be the reason the Fed cut its forecast for rate hikes in half this week. So even though you and others don't necessarily see a recession this year, what you're seeing is what I'm hearing, by the way, in the data is a recession proceeding towards us. There's one lying shortly ahead. But why not this year? What's going to hold it off? You know, why not earlier?
I mean, recessions usually come about over time due to excesses, Fed tightening, big buildups in inventory. That's why I mentioned that we're watching these inventory to sales ratios, because that is very indicative. If you're seeing weakening sales trends, as we're seeing in retail, then you would begin to see a buildup in inventory. We don't have any excesses at this point, unlike the last recession where you saw excesses in housing, or the recession that preceded it, excesses in technology. And we do have, John, one positive as a result of busting the budget caps in the last year's budget deal in November. We do have some fiscal stimulus coming from the government this year. The government deficit is going to increase by about $200 billion. So the government is spending more money this year. That's a positive for the economy. So there's still some oomph left in this economy. But we're in the final stages of this business cycle. I mean, we've talked about on the show, corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014. And we also believe that economic activity peaked in 2014. So the economy still may grow this year, but it will be at a slower pace. And right now, some of the regional LEIs have ticked up from the ECRI weekly index, the Philly Fed, to the conference board's leading indicators. So as we look at economic growth, once again, when we looked at the LEIs, there's somewhat of a mixed picture. So Q1 growth should probably pick up better than, let's say, Q4. But overall, John, the things we see point to an overall weakening trend, albeit it's still positive.
So to sum it up, no recession coming this year, but the overall trend going forward is for weaker economic growth and eventually a recession, probably next year. That's how far out the eventually goes. Anything that might cause you to change short term?
I mean, if the Fed was to change its tune, you know, obviously if they said, you know, we're just going to go on pause for a long period of time and indicate to the market they were going to do that, that would take a lot of pressure and that would probably change my mind. But I don't think so. If, for example, the economy was to strengthen, that would just give them more reasons to proceed with their rate raising cycle. They would be doing it every quarter as they originally planned. The only reason they pulled back to 2 rate hikes was because of a weakening trend. So I can't see that happening. If the economy strengthened, then they're going to go forward because then they would think that they would have enough safety to keep raising rates. That's what they want to do. In their minds, they believe that they would like to get back to a normal monetary policy where they take the Fed funds rate back up to their goal right now is to take it up to 3.25 is their basic projection. Normal Fed funds rates are usually at 5% or 6%. If you take a look at what Greenspan and Bernanke did, they took the Fed funds rate over to 5. Greenspan took it up to 6% in the recession of 2001. I mean, they would like to get back to that. In other words, reload the chamber with bullets. But John, I just don't see that. So unless there was a dramatic change coming at the Fed, where basically they said, looking at the economic data, looking where the dollar is, we're just going to sit back here and remain on pause for a while and allow this economy to heal itself. I just don't see them doing that. And even though they cut their rate forecast down to, let's say, 2 rate hikes this year, where it's expected they'll go in June and maybe after the election in December. John, you notice they didn't say, nope, we're done for now. They still are proceeding. We are going to be raising interest rates. So I just don't see anything that would change my mind. And given the things that we're seeing, the trend in retail sales, the trend at the periphery in unemployment, and also the buildup of inventory to sales ratios, those things are sort of little nuanced indicators that down the road, economic growth is going to be slowing. In other words, the trend for economic growth going forward is going to be slower, enough to remain positive for the year. And after all, this is an election year, which is why the president and both parties are going to spend an extra $200 billion of stimulus in the economy this year. So enough to keep the economy afloat this year. But if the Fed keeps proceeding, eventually all the trends we're seeing, John, point to weakening economy in the quarters ahead.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
John Butler, Vice President and Head of Wealth Services at Gold Money, joins us today. He was once ranked the number one investment strategist by Institutional Investor magazine. So you'd mentioned that negative interest rates are encouraging an expansion of the public sector. Do you think that we are collectively moving away from a free market economy and more towards a command economy where, of course, the government, the public sector, has just that much more influence in terms of market outcomes? I mean, do you see this progressively moving forward where, I mean, really every attempt is made to hold on to some semblance of influence or control over the free market, or really extinguishing the life of the free market?
Well, it's a great question, and I could speak about it for hours. We don't have that much time today, but I will make a couple brief comments. First of all, you know, Friedrich Hayek won the Nobel Prize for his work in economics, and one of his more eloquent pieces that he wrote, although he didn't specifically receive the prize for this, was his book, The Road to Serfdom, where he explained how even the best of well-intentioned government policies, sadly, can have unintended consequences, which in turn lead to expanded government policies to address those consequences. And through an iterative process, you erode a lot of the freedom that is associated with a modern liberal democracy. And that book was published in 1946, immediately following the Second World War, when Hayek was concerned that the command economy nature that was of the Second World War, you know, the countries that participated in it, a lot of the economies were run in a command fashion to prosecute the war. He was concerned that that mentality might be difficult to do away with in the post-war period. He was concerned that elements of the government, elements of the state would seek to hold on to some of that power or even expand it in future. And sure enough, we have seen a general expansion of the public sector in most of the modern liberal democracies over the course of the past 40, 50 years. And that may surprise some people because they think, oh, but what about the rise of the conservative movement? Well, yes, okay, fine. I mean, there has been a conservative movement and there was the experience of Ronald Reagan, for example. But if you simply look at the size of government spending relative to the economy as a whole, and this is true in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan, that public sector is substantially larger today than it was following the immediate post-war period in the U.S. and elsewhere. Substantially larger. I mean, it's night and day. So clearly Hayek's warning was a prescient one. And I would argue that, in fact, what we're talking about today is the road to monetary serfdom. That is, we've been on this road now for a long time. It arguably began in the 1980s under Greenspan. We've been on a road in which the central bank has got progressively more activist in managing the economy. Yes, of course, they lower interest rates in response to a downturn, but now they don't merely do that. They sometimes lower them very aggressively to prop up the stock market, such as Greenspan did in 1987, or they lower rates to levels that are outright negative in real terms. That is, when adjusted for inflation, you're actually losing money by leaving your savings in the bank. And, you know, that was also under Greenspan in the early 90s. The U.S. experienced a period of outright negative real interest rates. Then, of course, the Federal Reserve was sort of indirectly involved in helping to bail out Mexico with a small interest rate cut in 1995. Then the Fed was involved in bailing out long-term capital management in 1998. Then, of course, we know the dot-com bust in the early 2000s led the Fed to cut rates to nearly 1% and to speculate what they might also do in terms of unconventional monetary policy were that required. And then, of course, 2008 comes along, and we've seen now a string of conventional monetary policies, all of which were supposedly temporary emergency measures, but which have required a certain degree of prolonged and almost permanent. And of course, in Europe now, outright negative rates. In Switzerland, outright negative rates. Sweden, outright negative rates. Japan, moving towards outright negative rates. I mean, clearly, we're still on this road to monetary serfdom, where the effects of what the monetary authorities are doing, of course, they impact the entire economy in various pernicious ways. And I mentioned one, they encourage the growth of the public relative to the private sector. So where does this all lead? Sadly, it does lead in a rather dark direction in which capitalism, as we understand it, can simply no longer function. Beyond a certain point, you have to replace, you know, the word capitalism with something else. Many people would already replace it with crony capitalism, such as David Stockman, for example. He'll use that term quite liberally. Others might have another word for it. Some people might say we're on the road to outright socialism. I don't know. I can't tell the future, but the road we are on is certainly leading us in a very dangerous direction.
Welcome back again to The Big Picture. One characteristic we have covered here on the program over the last 7 to 8 years is how absolutely anemic this economic recovery has been. In the aggregate, it may not look as bad as you might think, especially for individual households, but that's an averaging of what the uber rich and everybody else makes. And so when you do, a lot of people haven't felt this in their own lives. It's been plagued by fits and starts since the recovery began. In addition, the economy has never hit the annual growth targets of 3 to 4% as forecasted by economists and Fed officials. Which Jim tells us something about the forecasts of economists and Fed officials, yeah? that maybe we shouldn't be paying any attention. Don't pay attention to the men behind the curtain. Okay, now despite trillions in government deficits and trillions of money printing by the Fed, there have been a number of explanations given for why not. Too much debt, too many regulations, high taxes, too poor fiscal policies. And there's some weight to all of that. However, there is another reason we're going to discuss today that is even more alarming for Americans. And this explanation lines up with historical evidence as well. Now you've really got my curiosity. Go ahead. Let's hear this.
Well, John, you and I have probably talked about this in the past. There was a book written by a Peruvian economist called The Mystery of Capitalism, Why Capitalism Triumphs in the West and Fails Everywhere Else. It was written by Hernan de Soto. And what made this book amazing, it was in strong opposition to the popular view that the reason that you saw success, for example, in South Korea versus North Korea, it was cultural differences. What De Soto found that it actually has everything to do with the legal structure of property and property rights. And this structure in the West allowed people everywhere to turn property into wealth. Now, remove property rights and the legal structure that protects it, and you have what the rest of the world has, which is wealth inequality and poverty. There was an article in Barron's this week, and the reason I'm bringing this up, because it really struck me, it was by Gene Epstein, that highlights this very, very point of what's happening to economic freedoms, because when you start taking away economic freedoms, it has a major difference in terms of what happens, whether it's wealth inequality, the speed at which economy grows, the wealth it creates, as well as the inequality issues that are so often discussed today.
You know, one of the other areas, too, is the, we would say government intrusion into property rights, because one of the things that Hernan de Soto pointed out is that what makes free society go, a robust capitalism, is the assurance that you own what it is you have made legitimately, whether it's property or patents or anything else like that. But we're seeing this is being eroded on through a series of different fronts. All around, what's most disturbing, especially for the area of freedom and robust capitalism, is the idea that we are being told more and more that the rights, say, in the Constitution and elsewhere, don't really apply. Or they'll say they do apply, comma, but, and then they start this list of when they don't apply, and it's what you call a death by a thousand qualifications. So whether it's land rights in the name of protecting the environment, property confiscations under forfeiture without trial, all of these things are putting at jeopardy the whole robustness of our capitalistic system. Not to mention, Jim, the middle class is struggling under the load of the taxes and the regulations, and this is burdening them as well.
Well, I mean, if we take economic growth, John, over the last 45 years, there's been a remarkable slowdown in the U.S., especially the last 15 years. I mean, under President Bush and Obama. Now, prior to the year 2000, economic growth averaged in this country exceeded economic growth rates of 3% a year. And since this recovery began, you've always heard the Fed, you've heard government economists and officials keep projecting that 3% growth rate, John. We haven't achieved it in the last 15 years. Since 2000, economic growth has slowed. Instead of the 3% plus that we averaged for almost 3 or 4 decades, the average since 2000 has been 1.7 to 1.8%. Now, this is rather interesting because, you know, the Fed met this week, and once again, they brought down their dot plot in terms of the number of interest rate hikes, and they also brought down their economic forecasts, given the anemic growth that we saw not only in the fourth quarter, but the anemic growth that we saw in the first quarter. So already they're projecting this year it's going to be 2.2%. So these anemic growth rates, no matter, I don't care how you break up the time frames looking at, let's say, the last 15 years. Now, according to Gene Epstein in his article in Barron's, he's citing an institute called the Fraser Institute of Economic Freedom Index for the U.S. Now, the index lines up perfectly with the slower growth rates we've experienced the last 15 years. Now, the index tracks the degree in which free market capitalism is allowed to operate. It rose, believe it or not, from the decade from 1970 to the year 2000, especially under Reagan and Clinton, which coincide with strong economic growth. Now, since 2000, the index has fallen, which is coinciding with weaker economic growth. Now, the index is made up of five components, and here's where we get to part of the DeSoto theory. Number one, the size of government. We all know that the size of government has gotten bigger. It takes a bigger portion of GDP. Number two, this refers to DeSoto, the legal system and structure in the security of property rights. Number three, the soundness of money. Can you believe we have a sound money policy today? Number four, freedom to trade internationally. And number five, the regulation of credit, labor, and business. Now, of the five components, they're all equally weighted, but economists say the second one, the legal system and property rights, have been acknowledged as the most important, which lines up with the work done by DeSoto.
Well, you can see this reflected in economic growth these last 15 years. I mean, it's one reason why most people in the country don't feel like we've had an economic recovery, and it feels like we're more like in a recession. And of course, we've talked about on last week's program whether or not we were actually turning down into a recession. Now, what the alarming trend in this election is that both sides want to limit economic freedom even more through higher taxes, more regulations, to trade wars. And you're also seeing extreme elements come out because people feel governments are no longer respecting their ideas. They're not being heard. They're feeling the pain. And that's where you see these populist movements coming out as well. Some of them are good. Some of them are extreme and not so good. Now, one only has to look at Europe or Latin America to see what the results are. In Europe, the growth rate is one half the growth rate of the United States. And the unemployment rate is more than twice as high, with youth unemployment 4 to 5 times higher. And the public doesn't understand why the things are so bad. They just know that their condition has worsened under both Bush and then even worse under Obama. And as a result, like we said, people are looking for someone to break the mold. And so it's not surprising to see the people and the support of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, you know, but it's very clear from some of the things these people are saying and the sort of hysterical cheers of approval coming back that the people in those audiences don't understand what's happening, Jim.
No, John, and there's a good reason why most Americans feel the way that they do today. I mean, there was a recent report out by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis that captures it all in 9 graphs, and it looks at things that are larger that really hit home at the kitchen table. Number one, student loans, John, in from the year 2000 to the present, it literally looks like a NASA space launch. Student loans almost went up eightfold. Food stamps in the last 7 years have taken off like a space launch. Federal debt. Bush doubled the national debt. When Bush, George W. took office, the national debt was $5 trillion. By the time he left office, it was $10 trillion. So George Bush doubled the debt of all his predecessors. Obama takes office, it's $10 trillion. When he leaves office in January, it'll be $20 trillion. So an increase in debt at the student level, which is why the Sanders free college education is popular. Food stamps, the largest amount of food stamp issuance in the history of the country. Federal debt, money printing. The Fed's balance sheet went from $700 to $800 billion to over $4.6 trillion. Healthcare costs are up almost 50 to 60%. since the passage of Obamacare. Labor force participation. That's why people say, oh, gee, well, we're down to a 4.9% unemployment rate, but there are more and more people that aren't participating. It's the lowest level since World War II in terms of labor force participation. Another graph, workers' share of the economy. In other words, workers' wages compared to, let's say, profits are the lowest that they've been in probably, you'd have to go back to the recession back in 1973-74. Median family income has been in decline for the last 15 years. And believe it or not, home ownership is at the lowest level it's been. So these nine graphs, John, reflects, I mean, you take a look at the graph of student loans, it literally, in the last decade, has gone straight up. I mean, it's not even at a 45-degree angle. It's like a NASA space launch. So, hence, the popularity of Bernie Sanders, hey, college is free, not realizing when you have a government monopoly that's fueled with cheap credit, student loans, you get credit chasing fewer goods. The price of those goods go up. In this case, a college education, which has been going up at the price of almost 8% a year. You take a look at food stamps, federal debt, money printing and health insurance costs, labor rate participation, worker share of the economy, medium income, home ownership, John. And it's no wonder people are angry. They're saying, you know what, this isn't working for us. So hence the popularity this year. And you really saw it on the Republican side, where anybody that had a track record as a successful governor, whether it was Jeb Bush or Chris Christie or John Kasich, have not pulled the kind of numbers that a Donald Trump pulls. And even take a look at, even though Hillary Clinton is winning because of superdelegates and will be the nominee for the Democratic Party, she does not draw the kind of crowds that Bernie Sanders does when he speaks on a college campus or he has a gathering. I mean, both Sanders and Trump following, they tend to garner large crowds that are very attracted to their message. So we wonder why people feel the way they are. Many people still feel that we're still in a recession. They don't have the kind of jobs they used to. Their wages haven't gone up. Businesses, there's more regulations, there's more taxes, there's bigger government. They're all synonymous with higher unemployment, slower economic growth, and greater wealth inequality, very much what you see in Europe today. What is not explained is that government is the problem, not the solution.
You know, this brings me back to the whole law and property rights thing I was talking about, because that's at the heart of Hernan de Soto's work. He said you have to ensure the stability of these things in order to get that robust middle class going that breeds prosperity. And this also lines up with the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom Index. You know, the U.S. used to be at an 8.65 on their index in the world, in other words, world ranking. It has now fallen to 7.73 out of a possible 10. Hong Kong right now is at the highest at 8.97. Venezuela, surprise, surprise, is at the bottom with a 3.23. And I don't know if you saw it, but people are actually, to get regular healthcare treatment now in Venezuela, Jim, patients are going across this river bridge into Colombia. They have to wait till the border opens every day for things like dialysis and other necessary ongoing treatments. And you have to recognize that Venezuela, until Hugo Chavez came along with his socialism, was a vibrant model of good economy in South America. And he wrecked it all in 1.5 presidencies. So that should be a lesson for us. But so far, the lesson hasn't learned.
No, it hasn't. In fact, the government is creating a lot of these problems. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week. It was called Hurdles to Multigenerational Living, Kitchens and Visible Second Entrances. And John, the new trend in this country, especially with wages being anemic, jobs being poor, are you're seeing extended families live in the same property to save money. You know, grandparents living with parents and even the young kids, a lot of the millennials staying at home instead of moving out. And what happened is a lot of these worsening economic conditions, which is what you would expect. You know, I can remember when my parents first got married, my grandfather, you don't see him too much out here. Maybe you see him on the East Coast. He had a 3-story flat, and of course, they had a basement. My grandfather was on the ground floor where he lived with his wife's mother. On the second floor flat, that's where my parents lived with my sister and I. And on the third story flat, that was where my aunt lived with her family. So it was multifamily generational living, and that's what we're going back to, living in the same property. But what's acting as an impediment has been government trying to restrict, for example, stoves, second kitchens, or second entryways to homes, and creating all these kind of prohibitions, everything from stoves to ovens to sleep fees for separate utility hookups. And it's just amazing. But here, once again, the government is out of step with the times, given the circumstances the way the economy is running today.
You know, what I've been predicting for a long time, Jim, is that what was going to start happening is we ran into these problems and they got worse and worse, very much like increasing hits at increasing frequency, increasing amplitude, is that people would just start throwing out one group of rascals only to put another group of rascals into politics. And that's the risk that we have in this election cycle right now, is that with the economy doing poorly and possibly heading into recession next year, then the public is going to elect politicians who actually reduce economic freedoms and make a bad situation worse. And we have an example of that going back to the time of the Depression. Remember in 1937, Roosevelt and the Congress raised taxes. Boom, the whole thing rolled right over and went down again. And if they had could have kept their hands off of it, it would have recovered by itself, you know. So that's the type of thing we're facing.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing to see what happens, whoever the next president is going to be, what kind of policies they pursue, whether more taxes, more regulation, which would create higher unemployment, slower economic growth, or if we move in the opposite direction. But, you know, neither side, I don't care whether it's Trump talking about trade wars or it's Clinton and Sanders talking about higher taxes and more regulation and bigger government. In neither of those work. A good example is just take a look at what's going on in Europe today as an example, or what's going on in Latin America, Venezuela, and other countries. So take away property rights and freedom, John, and this is what you get as a result. But anyway, it was an interesting article. You want to read the article. It is in this week's Barron's by Gene Epstein, Why the Economy Doesn't Grow. And it was rather interesting because as we've gotten higher taxes, more regulation, are we really surprised? There was also an article, too, in the last 7 years has been the worst in this country for the formation of new businesses. So all of this goes hand in hand with the loss of economic freedom.
Well, Jim, it looks like we're going to be playing the same old guessing game with the Fed that we played last year. Remember how we dragged that out over months? Well, will it be June? Will it be, you know, blah, blah, blah? And we kept analyzing that. And then finally, the end of the year, we go, whew. But of course, you didn't have a chance to see the result of it till into the new year. And then things really went hooey at that point. So that's something we're going to be watching, is what the Fed's going to be doing. Anything else on the horizon?
We're just coming to the close of the first quarter, so we're going to be getting into Q1 earnings season. We'll be watching some of the economic numbers, but I'd say the next thing on the agenda, you know, the Fed will be meeting in April, so we have a Fed April meeting. It'll be interesting to see if they give us indications based on the economic numbers that they indeed plan to raise rates in June. That's the consensus right now, with only 2 rate hikes expected. The first one is expected in June, and we should get some kind of indication at the April FOMC meeting if they're going to proceed in that direction. But right now, I think in about another week or two, we're going to start talking about corporate profits. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. befriend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.